Hello, everybody. I'm so excited to introduce you to today's speaker. This is Catherine Arnip. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. Very accomplished woman. She is a PhD, a writer, a speaker, a life coach, and a retired university professor. She is the author of dozens of books and articles, including the award-winning Education for Motherhood. She is a caregiver for her sister and her parents, or she was, when they were dying. She's been a hospice volunteer for more than 15 years. In her coaching practice, she works with people dealing with transitions, including aging, illness, and end of life. Her latest book, I don't have time for this, A Compassionate Guide to Caring for Your Parents and Yourself, tackles the final taboo, which is death itself. So welcome, Catherine.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
And can I also mention that she is a Canadian friend. She is with us from Canada, so that's very exciting. I actually really would just love you to tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit about your story, and then I've got a couple of questions that I'd love to make sure we get to during this 30-minute interview. So just
sounds great.
Share a little bit about yourself.
Well, you have some sense of it from what you've read. I have been an elementary school teacher, and then I went to graduate school, and after that, while I was in graduate school, I had two kids, two babies, so that led to me doing research on motherhood and advice for mothers, which led to my book that you referred to. And after I finished grad school, I got a job at a university, and I moved to Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada, and that's where I live now. Wow. And I was teaching and mentoring and being involved in other things, and I retired 4 years ago.
4 years ago?
Yeah, so I could write.
retired so you could
spend
write.
More time, right?
Yeah. Job, right? So how did you become involved in hospice and end-of-life care? Because, of course, that's very near and dear to my heart. I've been with hospice for 12 years now, so I'd love to hear your story.
It's a bit of a circuitous route. I had always been very afraid of death, even when I was a little kid. I was just kind of fearful of it, and we weren't really exposed to it very much. Growing up in the 1950s, you didn't go to funerals. Kids didn't go to funerals. It wasn't thought appropriate for them. So there was a real mystery around death. You know, my parents lost their parents, and that was all in the shadows. We didn't go there. My parents left, went to the funeral, and we never saw them again, but we didn't really know anything about it. And I didn't get any less afraid as I grew up. I think one of the things I've discovered is that if you just keep avoiding the thing that you're afraid of, that fear just grows and grows. Mm-hmm. But when my sister was diagnosed with terminal cancer, I really had to get over myself and my fear to be able to care for her. And so that's when I really came to terms with what serious illness and then ultimately dying was about.
And how long ago was that?
She died 20 years ago now. It seems incredible. It seems incredible to me that it's that long ago. But I was 47 at the time, and she was just turned 51 when she died.
Oh, wow, that's so young. I'm so sorry.
Mm. Yeah, no, it was a very, very hard thing in my life. And we had been very close. We were the middle children of four girls, and we just kind of looked after each other in a certain way, especially as we got older, and we'd always kind of promised that we would take care of each other if we needed it, and then, you know, I needed to take care of her, and that's what I did. So it really helped me to lose my fear of death and also to really understand much more about what dying people need.
And so is her illness, is that what brought you into the hospice world?
Absolutely. Okay. After she died, I told people I was transformed by her death.
Was she in hospice care?
She wasn't actually. In 97, there really wasn't much around. We had a We had a doctor who came to the house a few times, but mostly we were flying by the seat of our pants. Wow. I was reading and researching, and this is before the internet, really.
Right.
And there was no hospice in Toronto, and not really. You could hire visiting nurses, and we did that. And at the end, we hired a palliative care nurse.
Oh, great.
Who was really helpful in the sort of final week of her dying. So I didn't think right away, oh, I'm going to be a hospice volunteer. And in fact, after a death, you can't immediately become involved in hospice.
Right.
In general, it's usually at least a year or two.
Right.
It was about 4 years after she died, and I had been reading more and more about death and dying. And a hospice, a residential hospice, opened up near my house, about 6 blocks from my house. And I went and I took the training, and that's it. I became a residential hospice volunteer, and I've been there ever since.
Wonderful. 15 years.
And
I do want to circle back for a minute. You mentioned palliative care nurse. Mm-hmm. Some of the listeners may not know what that is. Would you like to explain what palliative care is?
Okay, palliative care is about symptom relief and so pain relief and any other nausea or other problems that someone might have at end of life. You can be delivered anywhere. In Canada, we tend to talk about hospice palliative care altogether. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have the same Medicare distinctions that you do.
Right.
But palliative care you'll see often in hospitals, and it's you know, to palliate means to wrap in a cloak, to care for, and that's the kind of care it is. There's no more treatment. There's no effort at curing. It's a recognition that the most important thing is the comfort of the person.
And so, did I hear you correctly? In Canada, you do hospice and palliative care together. You never separate the two?
We mostly talk about hospice palliative care together. The associations are called hospice palliative care.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Well, so for the listeners that are in the U.S., you can have palliative care and not hospice. And typically the way I explain it is, so hospice and palliative care, at least in the U.S., is a specialty. Just like if you had heart issues, you'd go to a cardiologist, or if you had cancer, you'd go to an oncologist. And the palliative part, and your mention of what the root word palliate means with a cloak, it also means to ease. Palliate means to ease. So if I had a cold and a bad cough, I will take cough medicine. It's not going to do a darn thing for my cold because there's no cure for the common cold, but it's going to make me feel better. Mm-hmm. So that's palliative care, anything that's pain and symptom management. And so in the U.S., and this is a question for you also in Canada, to qualify for hospice care, you have to have a 6 month or less prognosis, mm-hmm. the end of life, and you're no longer seeking curative treatment. Is that the same in Canada?
It's not quite as firm as that. You know, we would have, say, the hospice where I volunteer, we have a day hospice program, and people come one day a week. And that program is not restricted to people who are actively dying or even in the last 6 months.
Oh, okay. So
it is a little bit blurrier. But palliative care can definitely happen while you're having curative measures as well. You can have palliative care, the same as in the U.S.
Exactly.
And more people should be having it.
Yeah, exactly. Let me kind of finish real quickly this explanation. I want to hear more about this one day a week program you've got for your residential program. So the palliative part is all of hospice. Every single thing hospice does is palliative. It's all pain and symptom management.
Yes.
But it's also, because of Medicare, the definition is when you have a 6 month or less prognosis and you're no longer seeking curative treatment. But you can also just have the palliative part of it if you are seeking curative treatment.
Yeah.
So I think it sounds pretty similar, that you can have pain and symptom management while you're seeking curative treatment. You can have pain and symptom management, palliative care, when maybe you're not in that 6 month or less window and quite yet. Maybe you're 2 years out or, you know. But it's an advanced serious illness, and for whatever reason, you're not appropriate for hospice quite yet. Mm-hmm. So sounds kind of similar.
It's similar.
Yeah. Love to hear more about your residential program when you said they can come one day a week. Explain that a little bit.
Okay, so we have three main programs. Well, four really, if you count the grief and bereavement groups that we run. The day hospice is for people who have a life-threatening illness. They've been diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. They could still be in treatment. They could be in remission. And they come, they get driven to the hospice by a volunteer driver from our hospice program. And they get there about 10. They get 10 in the morning. And there's usually about 12 or 14 people there and a bunch of volunteers and a staff member. They have a little snack. They can get involved in the art program, painting and drawing, that kind of thing. There's a happy hour where you can have wine.
Oh, how nice.
And then they have a beautiful lunch made for them and tailored to any dietary concerns they might have.
Right.
So they have that lunch. They might listen to some music. We have a music therapist who comes in and plays music. Then they're picked up at about 2. So it's, you know, that's part of the programs that we run. And we also have a home support program where a volunteer can come in to visit usually once a week and provide respite for your caregiver and company for you. So that, again, that program can happen at any stage in a life-limiting illness.
Wow, wonderful. Sounds very similar to like a senior daycare type.
The day hospice program, it's like that, although you could have people in their 30s or 40s. Because anyone...
The qualifier is they have a life-limiting
illness. So, and we always do have a range of ages, not just seniors.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a great program.
And then you said you have a total of 4 programs, right? So what are the other 3?
So they run a number of grief programs. So there are specific groups for men, for spouses. There's a grief walk once a month with volunteers. There's some work with children, and we have a social worker as well who does grief work. And then the residents, which is where I volunteer. And we have 9 beds,
okay,
9 single rooms. And there the focus is on comfort care and also on the family. Mm-hmm. So the center of it is the patient, the person who's dying, but the family also receives a lot of care and comfort as well. And we as volunteers will often spend time talking to the family member or family members. And, you know, in the kitchen, hanging out in the kitchen and talking about how they're doing, that kind of thing, which you might not see, say, in a hospital program. It's pretty much just disease and patient oriented, whereas we're very much focused on the family and who they are, what issues they might have. And I spend quite a bit of time with family members, actually.
Yeah, so that's a very common thing we share, in that when you're in the hospital, it's pretty much all about the medical situation, about the patient. But hospice, I think the hospice philosophy is very much family patient. You know, it's as much about the family as it is the patient, because what if it happens to the patient affects the family, vice versa. So there's a big holistic approach to that family unit.
Yeah, sort of circle of care. We talk a lot about the circle of care.
That's exactly right. I wanted to look at a couple of these questions I want to be sure we cover. So you say in your book that caring for your sister taught you how to be with dying. What did you learn from her, and how did your sister's death transform you?
Okay. I was very much devoted to her. And I would say that love really motivated everything that I did. But I was also, like many people, I was 47, a couple of kids. You know, I was running a university department at the time. You know, I was super busy. Mm-hmm. And type A.
Stress probably.
Yeah, I was very stressed. And I would say that I was a type A person. You know, you got your list and you tick, 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 tick. And So when it's someone sick, and first you're hoping for a cure, and then you realize that someone's actually dying, still you've got your list. And there are a lot of things to get done. There really are. But what I learned actually from my sister Carol getting mad at me was that there's more to it than just your lists. At one point, it was near, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before she died, she just said, you know, I'm sick of it. All you ever do is talk on the phone and look at your lists and make arrangements for things. And, you know, you used to come here and watch TV with me. And we'd hang out and we'd laugh. And, you know, you may as well be at home doing this as be with me, because you're not really being with me. And I was really shocked. And a bit defensive,
right?
You know, and a bit defensive. Like, oh, hello, I'm doing this for you. I have to make these phone calls. You know, I have to call the life insurance people and all that. But I went home and thought about it. And I'm like, yeah, she's right. You know, time really is fleeting. And let's wake up to that fact. And you can do these things elsewhere. And the most important thing is to be, not to do. And that's what I would say. The biggest lesson I learned is that it's about being, a way of being, which involves sitting and listening and maybe laughing and talking, but maybe sometimes just sitting in silence. And it's not about rushing around. What can I do for you now? What can I do? Did you want some more water? Da, da, da. That stems a lot from our own fears that, you know, I won't have to pay attention to the fact that this person is dying if I'm running around getting her things.
Right.
And so I really learned a lot about slowing down and about being present with her. And those are lessons that I very much take into hospice when I'm with patients and families. You know, that I can come into a room and just get a sense of how the person's doing and what they might need or want. And it might just be my sitting there quietly. Or they might not even want me there. That's also possible. But getting a sense of that from the patient and not, you know, running around tidying up or doing things in the room. One of the things that I learned from Carol, again, was about the importance of giving a person in that situation. She was bedridden for most of her illness. Giving a person who's bedridden or not, you know, not able to get up and do, as much control as possible over things in their life. Maybe it does involve you doing something, but you do it on their instructions. At least they can have that kind of control. I remember vividly when I learned this lesson, because she said, she was in bed in her room, in her bedroom, and she said, could you just tidy up my dresser? And it's really bothering me. I was like, your dresser looks fabulous. You should see mine. It's got so much junk on it from the kids and da-da-da. And I was going on. I said, you know, just leave it. It's fine. She said, it's not fine for me. It bothers me and I can't fix it. And I just went, okay. And tell me what to do and what okay looks like for you. And I've taken that into the hospice. Mm-hmm. And I will often do things for patients, you know, they'll tell me, could you just close the bathroom door? I really don't want to be looking at it all the time.
Right.
Or could you fix that shelf? Or could you put that closer to me? And I hear sometimes people, family members sometimes or other volunteers say, oh, that person's such a control freak, you know? And I have to calm myself before I answer, but I say, you know, try lying in bed. Try being bedridden, having nothing. You know, you can see the thing you want, but you can't reach it. Or you know what you want precisely, but you can't get it for yourself.
Right.
You know, these people who are dying are losing control of everything in their life, absolutely everything in their body, including their body. And they are losing everyone they know. And what we can give them, what control we can give them, and decision-making power we can give them is really, really important.
I learned that from working with the hospice people here is exactly what you just said. There's so many things that they don't have control over anymore, whether they can't drive anymore or they can't walk without assistance or whatever it is, which just amplifies the importance of what they can't. If I want to watch Channel 12 or if I need to wear Depends, don't tell me I need to wear Depends. I'll decide when I want to wear Depends. You know, it's just because they can sense.
Oh yes.
This control that they're losing. Mm-hmm. So when you can say, "Mom, you're sitting there wet. You need to put on Depends." I mean, mm-hmm. that's kind of instructional,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to what do you think about wearing Depends? How do you feel about mm-hmm. that? And then he says, "You know what? I think I'm going to try that."
Yeah.
For a decision.
Yeah.
And it is all about control. That's such a good point.
Yeah.
So what were the last 3 weeks like with your sister Carol once she said, "You're not paying attention to me. We're not spending time. This is not quality time with you." So how did things change those last 3 weeks?
I spent more time asking her what she wanted and what do you need and what do you want? And so one day she said, it's time. You need to call my friends and I want them to come one by one. And I want to give them something. I want to give each one of them something. And I know, and then so I did make a list. but on her instructions, I made the list. And I wrote down the names of the people. And then for some of them, she knew. And she instructed me how to find those things.
I'm just interested, Alan. You go right ahead.
And so I did that. And then I called her friends. And they came in. And then I would ask her when they came, "Do you want me in the room or not?" And usually she said, "No, I can handle it. You could be in the kitchen. That'd be okay." Because by now she was in a hospital bed in the living room.
Okay.
And, when my dad came, she wanted me there to be there with her. And so those kinds of things. The other thing I did was I asked her questions about the end. You know, do you want to be cremated? Do you want some kind of a memorial or celebration of life? And we had an interesting go around with that because she said, "Oh, no one would come. You know, no one would come. It's summer." And it was just the very beginning of summer. And she was a teacher and most of her friends were teachers and they all take off for parts unknown in the summer. She said, "No one will come." And I said, "No, you're wrong. A lot of people will come." So I just kind of left that with her one day, said, "You just think about it." And then the next day I came and she said, "So what do you think we want to do at my party?" And I was like, "Oh, your party." And so then we talked about it. She gave me very clear instructions about what she wanted in terms of music and pictures and food. And she said, "And I want you to be the MC." Master of ceremonies. And I was like, "Oh no, it's going to be a tough one." But she was certain that I should do it. And it was a huge blessing to me to know that we were doing exactly what she wanted and that the people who she would have wanted to have speak were going to do that. And it was a beautiful party. It really was.
Well, and I'm so glad you challenged her when she wasn't going to do anything. I'm sure she's really grateful when you came back the next day that, you know, she taught you things, but you also taught her.
Yeah.
Oh, think about that.
Yeah.
You want to reconsider. And that's wonderful.
Yeah. No, it was. It was really beautiful. We just, after that happened with the rustling papers, we just got down to it. We just talked, you know. I asked her at one point if she was afraid. And she said that she was. And I said, "What of?" And she said, "Dying." And I said, "What part of it? What part of it?" And here's where I say I was flying by the seat of my pants and using love as the guide. I didn't know to ask that question. But so she said, when I asked what part, instead of having this huge whole thing, she said, "Well, I'm afraid, you know, I might suffocate, feel like I'm suffocating." And I said, "You know, I don't think that'll happen because there's medications that they can give you. So I don't think that's going to happen." And she was afraid that she might soil herself when mm-hmm. she died.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, because that sometimes happens, not always. And I said, "Well, I'll clean you up." And she said, "Would you do that? Are you kidding?" And I said, no, I would do that for sure. And they were very specific fears. And I sometimes say that to people now at hospice. I will either tell family members to ask their person, or sometimes I ask patients, you know, what specifically? And it's usually something like that, very concrete.
Right.
And you can alleviate their fears. It's not this abstract, you know, fear of not existing or those kinds of things. It's very practical.
Right.
And you can assuage those concerns. So that was one of the other conversations that we had. And we laughed a lot.
Yeah.
We always laughed a lot. And people would say, what are you guys laughing about? And we'd be like, well, what's the alternative? You know, we'd always laughed a lot. As sisters, we always did. We were always chatting and having little gossip sessions, and so we were doing it then too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was lovely. It was really lovely.
Well, for flying by the seat of your pants, you know, I think what guided you, you said it was love, and love guided you to ask all the right questions.
I think it did.
Yeah, it made that experience with her those last months just very special.
Yeah.
Very special.
It was.
That's so powerful.
It was a very powerful experience in my life. And, you know, it continues to guide me.
You may have already touched on a little bit of this. I wanted to know, what does your work in hospice care look like? What do you do exactly? What do you bring to your patients that you're meeting with? You may have touched on a little bit of that, but is there anything a little more specific you want to tell?
I mean, we do certain chores and help with personal care, but I think what I bring this sense of being able to be with dying and to be able to sit and to be present. Sometimes I'll sing because I love to sing. And so sometimes, you know, I'll ask a patient if they would like me to sing, and or if someone is, you know, not conscious in a coma or whatever, or deep asleep, and then I will sing, you know, usually lullaby, those kinds of songs, or and it seems to calm them down.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. I had one woman that I, you know, I was sitting with, and she was pretty agitated but not really awake, so I couldn't ask her anything, and I sang for a little bit but didn't seem to be doing anything. So I went back into the volunteer room to look and see what I could learn about her, and it said she loves country music and especially Patsy Cline. So I went back in, and I had my phone with me, my iPhone, and so I just went into iTunes and downloaded a Patsy Cline song and played it for her, and over, in fact.
Yes.
But as soon as it started, you could just see her relax.
Aww.
And calm down, and it was so beautiful. It was just like, of course, Patsy Cline, that's what you wanted.
Yes.
You didn't want my lullabies. You wanted Patsy Cline in there.
Exactly. So yeah. The fact that you said over and over, I know my family knows I love It's a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong.
Oh, yes.
And I told him, I just wanted on repeat. Just keep
going. Yep. It is a beautiful song.
Have you ever cared for any Alzheimer's patients? Because what they say about Alzheimer's is of so many areas of the brain that it affects, the emotions tied to music, particularly mm-hmm. from childhood, it doesn't seem to affect, which is why music can be so beautiful. And where nothing else seems to reach them, music will reach an Alzheimer's patient.
Yeah, no, it's true. If somebody comes with Alzheimer's, they usually have a terminal illness in addition to Alzheimer's. But I do find, you know, the old songs, you know, You Are My Sunshine,
yeah,
and those kinds of songs. I know all those songs.
Yeah.
And so I will sing those kinds of songs, and they'll perk up, and some of them know all the words.
Exactly. Yeah.
I figure whatever happens to me, I will know all the words, because I know so many songs.
Because you're a singer.
You know, yeah. And, you know, I had an older sister, so I've got her generation of, you know, Elvis and all of those songs,
right,
all the way up to, you know, to now. So it's, yeah, so I do use music, and I think it's a very powerful tool.
Right. So for the listeners here in the U.S., Alzheimer's is one of the terminal life-limiting illnesses,
mm-hmm,
or okay, it is a hospice diagnosis.
Yeah, okay.
Is that not the case in Canada?
The challenge, all I can say is, I understand what you're saying about a terminal illness, but somebody could have that terminal diagnosis and still live for many years.
Absolutely.
So in the case of the residents, we can't, you know, we tend to have people who are there for the last 3 months of their lives at the most, and the average is sort of more like 12 days.
Right.
And with only 9 beds, and there's only 20 beds in separate residential hospices in the whole city. So we do have to focus on a person at the end of their life. So it would be probably a dual diagnosis when someone comes in with Alzheimer's.
Well, and just for a point of clarification, it's always in the U.S. anyway, because of Medicare guidelines, it does have to be a 6 month or less prognosis.
Mm-hmm.
But the terminal illness
could be
Alzheimer's, okay. And they could have had it for years and years.
Right, but they're at that, yeah.
Yeah, and I always say, you know, every doctor's crystal ball is very foggy.
That's right.
It's their best guess, but the requirement is that 6 month or less window with the various terminal illnesses.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. I know we do this in the U.S., do you guys provide home care with hospice? So I hear about the residential, like a brick and mortar facility, but do you also provide care in the home? Because we do in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the biggest differences that we haven't touched on is that we have universal Medicare in Canada.
Right.
So everybody.
Big difference.
Yes. And it's certainly contentious right now in your country.
Oh, Lordy.
So everyone in Canada has access to universal health care. Home care is provided through some separate funding, and there's a lot of moves to get more home care provided for people so that they can remain in the home, because that's a big focus now, partly because it's cheaper than having someone in a hospital, but also people are pushing for it, even dying at home. People want to die at home.
That's right.
So you need a lot of support for that to happen.
Yeah. Yes, you do. So we're getting kind of short on time here. Let me just make sure. So real quickly about caregiving, because I want to respect your time. You write about the need to embrace caring and caregiving. What would a caring society look like?
Okay, well, I think a lot about that because I wrote my most recent book about caring for my parents, and it really made me think about what that looks like to care for people. And I think that in our society, we have a real horror of dependence, of being dependent on others. We're, you know, strong and independent. And I think that interdependent is where our culture needs to go and needs to move, because we, in our lives, move through a range of different things, of being in need of care and giving care, and sometimes both at the same time. And I think a caring society would really highly value that caring. And we would be, you know, some of it harkens back to earlier times, you know, caring for your neighbors, noticing someone hasn't been out for a few days, what's going on there? Or does somebody just need a knock on the door and see how they're doing? It involves young people, caring for grandmothers, it's all the way through the life cycle. And it involves supporting caregivers. And that's part of what I think a caring society needs to do. And I don't just mean financially, I mean really valuing what they do and the role that they play, the absolutely essential role that they play, especially in elder care, but throughout the lifespan. And that's part of what I'm talking about.
And I think you and your sister Carol are a beautiful example of how you just cared for each other,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a beautiful way and served each other.
Yep.
In a lot of ways.
No, we did. And my life will be forever richer because of that experience.
Right.
It really will be.
Well, before we go, I'm excited to tell the listeners that you are going to offer them a fabulous free gift. So would you like to explain what that is?
Sure. One of the things that I haven't really touched on is that I am a life coach, and I got involved with that as I was easing myself out of my job as a university professor. And I focus on helping people who are in those big transition places in their lives. Sometimes it's a divorce or moving homes or retirement. And sometimes it's dealing with someone that they love who's ill or dying. And so I talk to people, work with people, and coach them around these issues. So what I'm offering to people is kind of to have a try, give a taste of what it would be like to be coached by Catherine and in a 15-minute call, and see if it's something that they might want to take on in their lives or that might help them with the things that they're dealing with.
That's wonderful. That's, I mean, we've covered a lot of things in 30 minutes, so you can cover a lot of things in 15 minutes.
Yes, you can.
So that's so generous. That's so generous of you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So one more time, I want to make sure everybody knows how to get in touch with you. So this is Catherine Arnup. Her website is CatherineArnup.com, and I'm going to spell that CatherineArnup.com. And she's just written all kinds of books and has done all kinds of things. And I think, and I did want to mention, by the way, one of your books, I don't have time for this, Dr. Ira Bayek, who is a MD, he's an author, and he's also a professor at Dartmouth, gave you a great review on your book. So congratulations for that. He's a real pop star.
Yes, he is.
So I know you were thrilled about that.
Yeah.
So thank you for the free gift. Thank you for this interview. So many people are going to benefit from you, your story, your sister's story, working with your parents. So it's been a real honor, and I just can't thank you enough.
Thank you very much.
You are
great being with you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great.